give for that wonderful phrase.
Okay, now there's some Leonard Lopate music. There you go. I'm Andy Borowitz, and I'm in for Leonard Lopate. It's going to be sad to say goodbye. I've had such a good time this week. Jane Austen is one of those authors who inspires intense devotion among her readers, and her influence extends to the present. You know, you think about the movie Clueless, one obvious example. But what about her contributions to the English language itself? Well, the show's official word maven, I love how you branded that. You're the word maven.
Hey, I never made up the word. I never called myself that.
Well, you are the word maven, Patricia T. O'Connor, whether you like it or not. She's on the case today. She's joining me today for a look at What Would Jane Say? Her many best-selling books. This is Patricia, not Jane Austen. Jane Austen, that was a little confusing, include Pride and Prejudice, Emma. Now, her many best-selling books on the often confusing subject of grammar include You Send Me and Words Fail Me. And I'm glad she could be with me today. And if listeners have any thoughts on this topic, either now or during our discussion, feel free to call us at 212-433-9692. And you can reach out to us with a comment on the show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Okay, great. Jane Austen. Now, I must confess, I was an English major, but that was a long time ago.
So you never read War and Peace, her most famous book.
no, I read Pride and Punishment, though. That was an excellent one. So Jane Austen, I mean, we Jane Austen is constantly being remade and adapted. Her stories are so great, and her characters are timeless and all of that. But you claim that she also helped shape our language. So, tell me how she did that.
When people talk about Jane Austen, they call her the mistress of the ordinary, and that she drew these miniature paintings on ivory and did all this, these tiny little looks at little teeny feminine life, you know, and it's sort of belittling in a way, but
I'd rather be called word maven, to tell you the truth. I think mistress of the ordinary.
I'd rather be called Andy Borowitz.
Oh,
I mean,
come on. Let's cut that out right now. Mistress of the ordinary. So yeah, so that's kind of that is a slightly belittling, I would say slightly sexist way of talking about Jane Austen.
Well, yes, it is.
It's like she's just doing her little knitting and her little piggy point. Yeah,
her little
cameos. Okay.
Right. But actually, she was she's more of a linguistic innovator than she's always been given credit to be, largely thanks to the Oxford English Dictionary, which is tirelessly searching the published record for new things to add to its lexicon and its datings of words. And when Jane Austen's letters were published a few decades ago, the OED scoured them, and Jane's contributions to the language shot up as far as her the number of instances in which she had used a word first, or at least it appeared first in her works. And an Oxford literary scholar, Charlotte Brewer, has done some work on this and she actually gave a talk at a conference a few weeks back, and she recently noted that more than 200 words or new meanings of words have now been credited to Jane Austen, from her novels or her letters. And the interesting thing is that some of these are a little bit on the slangy side. You don't really think of Jane Austen as being slinging the slang. but let me give you a couple of examples. This is from one passage in Pride and Prejudice, and this is the scene. Mr. Wickham is sort of sucking up to Elizabeth Bennet. He's kind of courting her in a way, and he's bad-mouthing Mr. Darcy and blaming a lot of his bad luck in life on Darcy and saying that he screwed him out of an inheritance and all this. And he says, he was supposed to be getting this job as a clergyman in some cushy parish somewhere. But he says, you know, Darcy did him out of it. And he says, it would have been such a thing for me. The quiet, the retirement of such a life would have answered all my ideas of happiness, but it was not to be. Now, there are two two usages in there that were recorded here for the first time. The use of the word thing to mean a great event or something really important, such a thing, as in later to be no big thing, or what a big thing that was. Or the other usage was, it was not to be.
Really?
That was first recorded there in Pride and Prejudice.
Really?
Yes. And some other usages from her letters and novels, the expression to shut somebody up.
What?
Meaning to get him to stop talking. Yes.
Jane Austen invented shut up?
Yeah, Mansfield Park, 1814.
I thought that was Little Richard. This is changing everything.
Not shut up.
Oh, not
in,
shut up?
Hey, Mr. Wickham, shut up.
Shut up.
Not that.
Oh,
but
that's a little bit of a
would someone please shut him up?
Well, I think
or
she
maybe
still
someone
give him...
will shut him up.
Yeah.
So,
I think you
right.
still she I would also give her credit for shut up then. That's close
yeah,
enough.
Yeah, I think
for
that's
me.
Close enough. Another one is as cheap as dirt, which far predated dirt cheap. That's
wow.
from, yes, that is from Persuasion. All the honor of the family he held as cheap as dirt. Dirt cheap was a few decades later. Also, to get something over, meaning to get it out of the way, as in she wrote in a letter something she intended to get over before breakfast. So to get over something, meaning to finish it off. To bargain for, meaning to expect or count on. As in, it wasn't what I bargained for. Also, the word heavy to mean sober or serious, as in a heavy role in a play. Later, this developed into the heavy. He played the heavy.
Where did she use that?
She used that in Mansfield Park. And Mansfield Park has a scene in which, several scenes in which the characters put on a little play. And one of the characters is named Anhalt, and he's the heavy. And she describes Anhalt as the heavy role. Also, to knock off, as in to deduct or subtract. She wrote in a letter something about to knock off a week from the end of the visit. First time that was recorded. Here's one. This is interesting. Also from Mansfield Park. You know the expression, if I've told you once, I've told you 100 times? Jane. She wrote, it's true, I would not make this up. She wrote, if I've spoke once to Rebecca about that carpet, I am sure I have spoke at least 12 times. Someone talking about a domestic situation.
What's interesting, and you touched on this, is how colloquial all of these things
yes.
are. It's not like these are very strange.
No, they aren't.
You know, they're just very...
They're colloquialisms. And actually, her use of language was very natural. A lot of people, I think, have the idea that she was stiff and formal, but not so. Her language really flows nicely. And obviously, she's not making these things up. She's using things that were out there.
Right.
And she may have gotten them into print first. On the other hand, you know, things are being digitized all the time. It may turn out that she wasn't exactly the first.
Right.
But for now.
For now, for
right,
today.
Right. She was the first to use the term braces to mean suspenders, which is a really common British expression.
Yeah, braces as suspenders isn't as big a thing now. We don't talk about braces quite as often. That's not as big as dirt
Even
cheap.
Even in Britain, they probably don't wear braces that much.
Yeah, I'm not that impressed. Although I imagine in its day that was a pretty good invention.
Yeah.
I am talking to Patricia T. O'Connor, who is known around these parts as the Word Maven. And we're talking about Jane Austen, who has not only contributed to our culture, but apparently we're now learning has contributed slang and all kinds of other usages, all kinds of words, phrases that we didn't know, we didn't have in English before she came up with them.
Or we didn't have them recorded.
We didn't have them recorded. Okay, we're hedging a little bit. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. And if you have any thoughts on this topic about Jane Austen, about any of these phrases we're talking about, or really anything about English usage, you know, questions you have, because after all, we do have the word maven here. I just feel like it's important to your brand that I keep on saying that. Feel free to call us. We're at 212 833-9692. And you can also go to our show page, WNYC.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Now, you talked about, just to put a punctuation mark on one thing you said, she said cheap as dirt, and that became dirt cheap over time. Did you track the evolution of that? Do you know where it first appeared as dirt cheap?
I think it was the 1840s. I did look it up, but I didn't write it down. So it would have been, 20-some years, a little over after she died.
You know, something you said about the natural dialogue and the natural, the ease with which her language flows in these books. Do you think that also contributes to some of the diminution of her status when people call her, you know, a miniaturist or a creator of these little, you know, these little cameos? Because it's the people who use extremely sort of muscular, extravagant language that sometimes get your attention with all their pyrotechnics. But the you know, somebody like her, like Alice Munro, is another writer who writes very, very simply, and it's so brilliant. But some people just don't, you know, don't get her. They just say, "Oh, well, she's just writing about small town life. What's the big deal?
Right,
like, why
right.
is everyone saying she's Chekhov?"
You know. Right. Well, you know, if you look at a contemporary of Jane Austen's, Walter Scott, who was wildly successful in his time. Hugely successful. You try to read him now. I mean, my good heavens, he's really what a slog. It's really hard to get through his stuff. It can be done, of course, but to turn then to Jane Austen is a relief, just a relief. She was writing very naturally, and I don't think she was setting out to impress anybody. But I think it's always the simple, simple works that are the ones that survive in the long run. And simple is a deceptive word. You know, it's really what it is clear.
Right. Do you have a favorite Jane Austen novel?
I guess Pride and Prejudice. Yeah, and I think the only problem with Pride and Prejudice is that it doesn't really have that scene in it where Mr. Darcy comes out of the pond dripping wet in his light linen shirt with his muscles rippling, and we don't get to see him taking his baths and things like that.
So if you were to rewrite it, you'd
right,
put all
if
those
I were rewriting it, I'd put a little more of Darcy in his, you know, sweaty, muscle-bound clothes.
Okay, so I think I see the appeal of that thicker book to you. I learned a little bit more about the word maven than I set out to do at that point.
Right, and I'd also put in a little more description, making him look a little more like Colin Firth.
Okay. Yeah. Now I know. So what are some of her other neologisms?
Oh, well, actually, not everything that she came up with was so slangy and offbeat. A lot of ordinary usages, like the word for stroll, to mean a leisurely walk, as a noun, a stroll. Another word. The noun professional to mean a person who's paid as opposed to an amateur. She used it in a letter of 1811. She wrote, "There is to be some very good music, five professionals besides amateurs." It's the first recorded use of the noun professional to mean person who gets paid for his work.
Interesting. Hey, also, you know, we've got a Jane Austen fan on the line. Should we give this a try?
Oh, good. Let's grab that person.
People are starting to talk about, we're getting the world talking about Jane Austen. Let's see how this goes. Hello?
Hello.
Is this Ken?
Yeah, this is Ken in Manhattan. I know that Jane Austen is recorded as the first person to mention to write about baseball. And I wonder what exactly she was referring to. What was the baseball that she was talking about? It's in Northanger Abbey.
You know, you got me there. I went through the OED the last two or three days looking at all the references that Jane Austen has in there, and I didn't come across baseball. I would have remembered that, I think.
Yes,
but do you remember
pretty sure I'm pretty sure I'm right.
I thought it was the Vikings. Baseball. The Vikings really mentioned baseball for the first time.
No, the Vikings were football.
Oh, okay. Oh, of course. Of course. I'm a little slow today. Well, I don't, Ken, are you really being serious, or are you just pulling our
line? No, I'm not joking.
You're really serious.
If you look up baseball in the OED,
just don't mess with the word,
it will say Jane Austen.
Oh, okay.
Really?
I'll check that out.
That blows my mind. Did she invent baseball, do we think? No? No?
Okay. Gosh, did cricket even exist back then? It probably did.
Do you remember, Ken, you don't remember the context of
yes,
Jane Austen's baseball commentary?
I do. It's the heroine's talking about the heroine's childhood, that she played baseball.
Wow.
Well, maybe someone who's listening will check it out in the OED.
Somebody
and call
quickly
us.
Read Northanger Abbey.
It's in the early pages. It's not very deep in.
Interesting.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Right side of the page or left side?
All right. Well, I guess, Ken, thanks for educating us. We don't have a good answer on that.
Well, there must be something in it. Ken does not sound like the kind of guy who would make something.
No, Ken sounds serious. Yes. He wouldn't stay online to just... Yeah. Okay, well, you know what? If one of our other listeners can figure out what Jane Austen was referring to when she talked about baseball in Northanger Abbey, which I must confess I haven't reread recently.
The fan who calls in would have to be both a fan of baseball and Jane Austen.
Yeah, that's a Venn diagram.
Tough one.
Although let's not be sexist here. You know,
I know.
I feel you're being slightly sexist towards the dudes.
No, I don't mean it. I don't mean to be.
Okay, because I am a fan of both.
Of baseball and Jane Austen?
Yeah, I would say right now maybe a little bit more a fan of Jane Austen at this point.
Oh.
But no, I think it's safe to say that a lot of people like both. But that would be fascinating to know what she meant by that in Northanger Abbey. I was also kidding about having read it to begin with. I've never read
it. Maybe it was hide and seek, and she was talking about back to home base or something.
Oh, is that possible?
I can't remember Northanger Abbey that way. It's not one of my favorites.
Never read it.
Yeah, I've read it, but it's not one of the stronger ones.
Okay, besides Pride and Prejudice, what are your other favorites?
I like Emma very
Emma's
much.
Emma's fantastic.
It's
Emma's
wonderful.
Fantastic.
It's wonderful. And it's also one of those books that you can reread it every 3 or 4 years and enjoy it all over again because you just see so much more in it. I sounds trite to say that, I know.
No, but I think Emma may be my favorite of all the Jane Austen. I haven't read Northanger Abbey. Now I'm fascinated by what's in there.
Yeah.
What other things should we be giving her credit for? What other words?
Let me see.
There's
so many. I know.
Yes.
Actually, on the more feminine side, she did come out with the first recorded use of the word style, meaning a mode of dress, and with stylishness to mean fashionableness. Style was Mansfield Park, and stylishness from Northanger Abbey.
I want to talk more about that whole issue,
okay.
Because style is a big part of Jane Austen.
Oh, yeah.
I'm speaking with Patricia T. O'Connor. She's here for her monthly discussion of English language and grammar, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page or find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is @LeonardLopate, and we'll be back with more after a break.
To hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and man, it's hot out there, and I think a good way to cool off is to think of England, don't you? Because it's always a good 10 to 20 degrees cooler there. And think of Jane Austen, perhaps. Never broke a sweat, exactly. I'm talking to Patricia T. O'Connor, of course, our word maven, and she has brought in a whole bunch of words, phrases, contributions to the English language that we can credit to the great British novelist Jane Austen. I'm just curious, Patricia, how did you land upon this topic? What made you think about Jane's contributions?
Well, I regularly read something called the American Dialect Society list. It's a discussion group among linguists.
Oh, you don't need to tell me what that is. Of course, I'm always... That's my homepage, actually.
ADS? Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. And someone there mentioned this, the work of this Oxford Professor Charlotte Brewer mm-hmm. on Jane Austen and her contributions to lexicography. So I checked it out, and I thought it would be an interesting subject for our readers.
Well, it is.
It is.
It is. Now, yes. What are some of the other... You were talking about style mm-hmm.
And stylishness. Mm-hmm. Those are two of her words for which she was the first to get them on paper in writing. Also, washed out to mean faded. And she was using it literally. She's used it of a dress of hers that was washed out. Also, livable, meaning suitable for habitation. That's from Mansfield Park. There will be work for 5 summers at least before the place is livable.
Now, Patricia, I don't mean to get you overexcited, but I think uh-huh. one of our listeners may have an explanation to this baseball mystery.
Oh, good.
About
Jane good.
Austen.
I'm all excited.
So let's... first of all, an author named Julian Norridge spoke with The Telegraph in 2008 about the reference to baseball in Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey and said, there's no doubt baseball was being played in Britain. This is hilarious. No doubt that it was being played in Britain in the late 18th century, and equally no doubt that it graveled to America. Well, I don't believe that at all. I think that's just revision history. But we do have a listener.
Uh-huh.
Let's ignore what The Telegraph told us.
Okay.
We do have a listener, Adrian, in Hastings-on-Hudson. And I believe Adrian is going to resolve this mystery. Adrian, are you with us?
I am.
How are you?
I'm thrilled that my useless knowledge is useful to someone besides myself.
You have a great future on public radio if you have useless knowledge.
Well,
you could really sign you
say,
right up.
Of all these years of wanting to call in with something, I find myself that master's in English lit and obsession with Little League might finally pay off. But I'm currently reading not Jane Austen. I'm reading a great book called Baseball in the Garden of Eden by John Thorne. And it's the subtitle is The Secret History of the Early Game. And I don't think it has Mr. Darcy coming out of the water, you know, in a wet shirt or anything, but it does make the early history of baseball a little more interesting than normally. And it talks about Northanger Abbey in a couple of places. And basically, the early origins of baseball in England was a game called Rounders.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And it wasn't played in exactly the same way as baseball as we know it today. That didn't happen, apparently. And although I'm not all the way through the book, it didn't happen until the 19th century in the U.S. to be played closer to the way we know it now. And that's when it became known more regularly here as baseball. But they think when she said baseball, what she meant was this earlier game that was really called Rounders.
Mm.
And
did they use bases? Is that's why she was referring to it as baseball? Or
well, it says. Do you want me to read a little to you? Do you want me
sure.
to paraphrase?
No, read. You know, we get in trouble sometimes when we paraphrase things. For example,
okay.
I just want to point out that when I read that quote that was typed on my screen from The Telegraph, I said that. This guy graveled to America. I thought that graveled was some kind of British slang, which meant like sort of, you know, like a gravel road or like, you know, and actually it was a typo on on somebody in the movie. No, it wasn't gravitated. It was traveled. The word traveled.
Oh.
But you see, this is how usage starts, which is
right.
some dude
graveled.
Like me misreads. Now, somebody types it in wrong. I, like a chimp, read it wrong. And suddenly people are saying, hey, I graveled to Brooklyn tonight. That's how it all starts. So
yeah.
This is how we get new words.
Well,
anyway, I'm sorry.
Didn't grovel. I thought it groveled over, so
no.
I misheard it as well. Okay.
So anyway, in your gravels, you encountered the term rounders, which is like
right.
a primitive, primordial version
right,
of
where
baseball.
they had bases, but they had a lot more people on the field, and they didn't use a glove. They beamed people with the ball.
By the way, that was true in American baseball in the early days as well. Did you know that?
Yeah,
you could get somebody out by throwing a ball at them. That was like dodgeball.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It must have been a lot of attrition.
Yeah, it wasn't a good idea.
Among other things. So it says here, in England we have references to baseball in Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey. and in Mary Russell Mitford's Our Village, published in 1824. In an English novel by John Kitchell, The Card, and a diary by William Bray, both from 1755. And in a miniature children's book by John Newbery called A Little Pretty Pocketbook from 1744. But these references are to games played in a spontaneous manner by children, young women, and in the Bray diary, young people of both sexes.
Hmm. And they were called baseball.
Right, but it was earlier in the book he says that it was more similar to what they called rounders than what we call baseball. And then it says, regarding the earliest citation for baseball played in America by precisely that name, a prohibition against its play in Pittsfield, Massachusetts in 1791. That game, too, was played on a pickup basis, probably by boys rather than young men.
Well, Adrian, thank you so much. We're going to keep this going because we have another caller who is talking about the same topic. So we're going to say goodbye to you and thank you. And
thanks so much.
Thanks for calling. And I'm going to bring in someone else in a moment. I just wanted to say that I'm Andy Borowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lopate. Only 10 more minutes of this great job. I love this job, and I have to say goodbye in 10 minutes. But I'm talking to Patricia T. O'Connor, our word maven. She's making her monthly visit. She has graveled to our studios.
Semi-monthly now.
Yeah, semi-monthly.
Or bi-monthly, whichever it is.
Whichever it is. And, well, you should know, for heaven's sake. If you don't know, who does know? And we were talking about Jane Austen, but I'm pleased to say we're now talking about baseball. This has now become basically sports talk radio, but of the 18th century. I want to bring in Kate from Brooklyn, because she also, I want to give her some credit, because she seems to have been hot in pursuit of 18th century English references to baseball as well. So, Kate, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
How are you?
I'm excellent, thank you. Now, it was fun hearing about rounders.
Now, you sound like you might be of some British derivation. Is
yes,
that true?
Yes, definitely the real thing.
Where are you from?
Actually, I think that lady, Adrian, really covered everything that I was calling in to say, because I did find, and really it's just Wikipedia.
Oh, so in other words, you have Google. That's impressive. So we're good now, just Googling things and calling in. That's great. That's good. So you Googled the same question and you came out with the same information. That's good.
Well,
but that's cool.
Well, I was looking up rounders because I really couldn't remember.
Mm-hmm.
So the 1744 thing. I thought
you thought that was well. That's cool. Now you.
And, well, that's enough of me. Okay.
Oh, you don't really want to get into it any further.
No, I certainly will. Go ahead.
I just want to ask you: where are you from in Britain?
Oh, I'm from Kingston upon Thames,
mm-hmm.
which is a town 50 miles southwest of London.
Mm-hmm. And
what's your favorite Jane Austen?
That's
novel?
What I was going to ask. Exactly.
Oh,
let's
gosh,
get an authority.
Probably Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, yeah. There you go. And since coming to America, you live in Brooklyn. Have you become a baseball fan at all? Are you more?
Oh gosh,
into,
no, not at all.
You're more into rounders, probably.
No, occasionally soccer and definitely Wimbledon.
Oh, cool. Well, this year, of course, you're into Wimbledon.
Well, every year. Even you know, Federer loved him, too. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations on what happened this year. That was
thank
amazing.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm just
love
trying to...
Love the show. Love the show.
Okay, thanks so much, Kate.
Thank you.
All righty. So, anyway, we kept that sports conversation going as long as possible. Now, I guess we have to get back to
yeah.
novels, to the English language. That's fine. That's
mm-hmm.
fine. We can play with that, too.
Yeah.
Okay. She didn't have the very first.
Well, the way these things work is that people are always going through old records looking for earlier and earlier appearances of certain words. And
mm-hmm.
it's a great sport, really, as well as a profession for some lucky people. And a lot of these things are going to turn out not to have been original with Jane Austen. For instance, this Oxford scholar I was talking about said that she had the first reference for dinner party.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look it up in the OED, she does.
Mm-hmm.
She has the first reference for dinner party. And I think it's in one of her letters. But since her talk, some other linguists have found at least two earlier examples from the 1700s and from 1800. And one of them was even from Providence, Rhode Island. So she doesn't really have the first example of dinner party. But she had her ears open. She was using the colloquial language of her day, and she was getting it down into print. And that's what's important. Mm-hmm. For instance, she used the word wild to mean crazy about something, to mean as in excited or enthusiastic.
Mm-hmm.
Using the word wild.
Where did she, like, I'm wild about that. Yeah.
Right. She
where did
used
she,
it.
Where did that come in?
Oh, gosh. I didn't write down where it came from. I think it's in two of the novels.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't write that down, though. But mm-hmm. I think it's in two of them. And she wrote, for instance, this is beyond me,
mm-hmm.
Meaning I can't comprehend
right.
something.
Right.
That was the first use. To catch someone out. In a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
That was from Emma.
Mm-hmm.
The word nice looking for pleasant in appearance. She's a nice looking woman. She wrote that in a letter in 1807. So, and there are an awful lot of these. As I said, there are about 200 of them.
Well,
so I'm just scratching the surface
well,
here.
Well, Harriet in Manhattan, who seems to be a Jane Austen fan, has something to contribute to this discussion. Can we bring Harriet on the line here?
Hello.
Hi, Harriet.
Hi. How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you?
Good, good. And enjoying the show very much today. I had a question. I was just wondering, Patricia seemed to have mentioned occurrences quite a bit from Mansfield Park and Northanger Abbey. And mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, were there equal amounts of things that were new words that were noticed in all the novels, or
oh,
does
yeah.
it seem to be something that clustered more in later novels? Or?
Well, actually, the novel with the most is Emma, mm-hmm. With the most new meanings,
mm-hmm.
By far. And
oh,
then
that's
really
also interesting if it was with most.
Yeah, most of them are from Emma.
Mm-hmm. How many in Emma?
Well, there are about the... Let's see. I think I have it here somewhere. 300-some. I think those aren't new usages, but just quotations in the OED, 300 from Emma. But a lot of these usages are from Emma. But looking through this list, I see a lot of other ones. For instance, Sense and Sensibility has a lot. I haven't mentioned that one. Sense and Sensibility has the first use of engagement to mean a betrothal.
Wow.
Yeah, that's very Austenish. And also the first use of chaperone as a verb and the first use of marry well to mean make a successful marriage in material terms like status or money or whatever. To marry well, that's Sense and Sensibility. To mix, meaning to mingle socially, that's from Emma. And, here's one, intentions. The use of the plural noun intentions, meaning thoughts in respect to marriage. That's from Pride and Prejudice. The sentence is, Colonel Fitzwilliam had made it clear that he had no intentions at all. And the the subtext is intentions towards proposing. So
well,
there you go.
There you go. Well, it's great stuff. And if for nothing else, you've gotten us all to go back and read our Jane Austen, which is a wonderful thing. I've been speaking with our resident word maven. I just had to say that one last time, Patricia T. O'Connor. And you can email Patricia directly. This is her her email. At mailbox@grammarphobia.com. Is that right?
Mailbox, yes.
Grammarphobia.com. She'll be back on September 18th for one of her usual visits. And Pat, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me, too. Great job you did this week.
Oh, gosh. Thank you.